You're listening to Food Confidence, a podcast about approachable health and imperfect food, all for the sake of the next generation. I'm Jennifer Bravo.
And I'm Andrea Paul. We are two non-diet health professionals on a mission to empower parents and caregivers in raising food and body confident kids.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Food Confidence Podcast. On today's show, we have Erin, a food science babe, a chemical engineer and food scientist with over 10 years of experience in both the conventional and organic food sectors. Erin shares scientific myth-busting information on Instagram and Facebook, helping her audience navigate sketchy information circulating the web about food, agriculture, and farming.
We are so excited to share this episode with you all today. I think one of the main reasons we wanted to have somebody on this podcast like Erin, like the food science babe, who's so well-versed in, you know, food science and chemistry and the organic and the conventional side of food production, is because we feel it's a really good fit. It plays in really well with the intuitive eating side of things. So one of the myths that we might hear about intuitive eating, or that we commonly hear about intuitive eating, which we'll probably talked about on a separate episode, is this idea of, well, what about health? And as a dietitian, I certainly want to be encouraging people to eat fruits and vegetables. And I know Jen feels the same. Mm-hmm. You know, we want you to be eating all kinds of foods, including things that you're going to find in the produce section. But where it becomes an issue is we see people avoiding produce or avoiding certain fruits and vegetables because they're afraid of it being non-organic, afraid of GMOs. And that fear is really in contention with making informed, compassionate choices mm-hmm. for yourself and for your family.
I think Erin does a really good job at speaking to that too in this episode, because she's able to share from a really informed place. She's a food scientist and she's been in both sectors and she knows exactly what she's talking about. And so she's able to really speak to the science of it and the safety of all foods. You know, this episode is really important for me, especially because I'm coming from the holistic health world and, you know, the integrative medicine world, where we really just find ourselves erring on the side of caution, which we think is the organic foods world or the non-GMO world. And a lot of the marketing information that we're fed is untrue and is just straight up, you know, misinformation. And so her perspective was really eye-opening for me, coming from a world of, you know, the clean 15 and the dirty dozen. So, you know, this episode is really important for us because it shares some information that I think is hard to find in mainstream media. It's information that is kind of foreign to a lot of us. And the idea is to empower you as parents and caregivers, or just as individuals, you know, to feel confident in making the decisions that are best for your body, that are best for your budget, that are best for anything that you're craving. I mean, like, the list goes on. We want you to be coming from a place of food freedom and not food anxiety. So I hope that this episode sheds a little bit of light and frees you from the burden so that you can just make the best decisions. Before we get into our conversation with Erin, a food science babe, we did have a listener question come in that we wanted to answer for you all today. So here it goes. The listener says, I was raised in a pretty boring, highly processed food household. My mom never cooked, and we only ate frozen pizza or boxed mac and cheese. My diet has definitely improved. I don't struggle with food guilt and can't relate too much to diet culture. However, I do have a hard time figuring out how to create a healthy diversity in meals for my family. I tend to stick to the same dozen meals, and it gets boring. Any tips for this? That's a great question. And, you know, we often do hear when we're combating diet culture, you know, it sounds like these extremes exist for a lot of people, but really a lot of people exist in that middle ground where they're exposed to diet culture, they understand it, but they're living somewhere in between those feelings. And so a lot of people say, you know, they're just kind of struggling with finding that balance between health and freedom.
And I think it can be, even if they're not maybe embodying those or like acting on those diet culture messages, I think it's great that this person doesn't have any kind of guilt around, you know, processed foods or quote unquote highly processed foods. I think that's a real benefit because I do think that those can kind of play a role in, you know, a balanced diet with variety. But I think a lot of people might struggle with some guilt if they're like, you know, defaulting to frozen pizza or something like that. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, definitely in like the culture that we've bred and how we've demonized certain foods. You know, you might still reach for a pizza frozen, right, but you might feel not so great about that choice.
Right.
And that's where diet culture plants the seeds and kind of rears its ugly head for a lot of people. But the question really is coming down to diversity and how to create diversity at mealtime, which is something I know a ton of people struggle with.
Right. And I think you have a lot of experience with this because you are a trained chef and mm-hmm. you kind of have that intuitive knowledge and also that like skill set of how to combine different foods.
Yeah.
I kind of have my own experience with that, but if you want to
share
kind of how you would approach this.
So I think like when it comes to feeling overwhelmed with boredom around food, when you're just kind of like, now what do? I want to make this big change. I want to be excited about food and I want it to be diverse. We can kind of get ourselves into the all or nothing mentality, which is definitely a diet culture thing, especially when it comes to like healthy diversity, so to speak. So my biggest piece of advice is actually don't go all in and change everything you're doing because it probably won't stick and it's not going to last. So really instead focus on making teeny tiny changes in your meal preps and meal planning. And an example of that could be like one week you could say, let's get parsley today at the grocery store. And what that means then is when you make, you know, your spaghetti and meatballs that week, you add parsley to the top of it. And that all of a sudden elevates that dish. Doesn't make it anything new or different for your family, but it elevates it and it makes it exciting. And it's making you think a little bit more about that dish that you're creating. And then later in the week, when you still have more parsley left over, you could decide to add a new Greek dish to your, you know, weekly meal planning. And you could make like an orzo with lemon and parsley. And then all of a sudden you've introduced one new food that you could use throughout the week that made enough of an impact that it's creating that diversity and that excitement around food without taking up too much brain space.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. Like going to the grocery store and maybe picking out like one new food or one new produce item or even like a canned food or a new grain and try to kind of create a meal around that. And I think, you know, Pinterest mm-hmm. is a really great resource to find new recipes. Like if you went to the grocery store and got, you know, farro, for example, which is a really kind of like hearty whole grain, you know, farro recipes, and you would find mm-hmm. some recipes that might pique your interest.
Yeah. And that, you know, that new recipe could be in place of a new produce. You could just say, okay, let's do one new recipe today. Right. Depending on where your comfort level lies with cooking, if you're comfortable improvising, then pick one new produce. If you're not comfortable improvising, pick one new recipe and learn what new ingredients, you know, that recipe calls for. And that creates that diversity without going so far that you feel like you're suddenly changing all your ways and you have to buy a whole new pantry or stock your fridge differently. It's those small changes that really add up, and that's where diversity is actually created over time. So I think that's what I have to say about it. What about you?
So I think for me, like if I was, you know, in charge of meal planning for mm-hmm. a family or something like that, I would try to get other people involved.
Ooh, yeah.
Because one, I don't think it's necessarily fair for one person to have the burden of like planning out all the meals. I know like I'm just a family of two plus a fur baby. And, you know, I even, you know, with my interest in food and like I'm on Pinterest pretty regularly, like I still find myself like racking my brain for something new to put into the meal plan every week. Yeah. So, having that input from other people and having it not all be about your preferences. And I think that also, like, if you have young kids or even, like, older kids, that might pique their interest to, like, hey, maybe I should, like, help out with this dish or maybe you know, they just have more buy-in to those mm-hmm. foods, especially if you're introducing new recipes that you're yeah. not really sure that they're going to go for. So yeah, that's kind of just my two cents, is just to get yeah. more people involved and try to, you know, get them to be creative. Yeah.
Another idea that reminds me too is if you have older kids who can really participate in the planning, you know, find out what they're interested in. Like, I have a friend right now who, you know, is watching a TV show that is kind of a, has a cult following right now. And every Sunday they make, you know,
It's Game of Thrones.
I'm assuming not a lot of kids are watching Game of Thrones though. But it could be, you know, it could be whatever they're into, and make and theme a meal around a movie that they just saw, or a television show, or a culture they're learning about in school.
Oh, try that's to, a like, great idea.
Pull in from their life outside of food and get them excited. And then that kind of like, yes, you do have to go and find a recipe and make it themed, but it creates that diversity and it keeps it interesting and exciting.
Right.
And
yeah,
it's a food ritual then that you can have within your family, which is so important.
Right. And I've heard from a lot of families, or a few families that like watch cooking shows pretty religiously.
Yeah.
And that gets their kids really excited to get in the kitchen too. So
right. And if you're watching a cooking show and they have one ingredient that you guys don't cook with very frequently, you know, it doesn't have to be, you don't have to emulate Chopped and make a Chopped box for your family, which would be really fun, but you don't have to. It could just be like, oh, pancetta. You know, we're a bacon family. Let's try pancetta today or yeah. this weekend or whatever. And it can just be like, you know, those little tiny adjustments
right.
based on any cultural cue that you have coming your way.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I hope that answers your question. Thank you so much for submitting it. And as always, if you have any questions about the information you hear in our shows, or you just have questions in general about intuitive eating, send us an email and we will be sure to answer it.
And now here's our conversation with Erin, aka Food Science Babe.
Hi, Erin. Thank you so much for being on the show with us.
Hi.
So let's get started. I'm curious for our audience to hear about who you are and what it is that you do.
Yeah. So I work as a food scientist now, kind of doing just independent consulting work. But how I got started was I went to school for chemical engineering. That's what my degree is in. I started out in the food industry more of in an engineering position in a corn milling plant in Iowa. Kind of realized I wanted to get more into the food development side of the food industry. So at the time I was working for a conventional ingredient company, working on snack products, anything from granola bars to cereals, stuff like that. At the time, I myself was more of an organic foods consumer. I sort of believed that type of food was healthier. I thought I was being more healthy by eating that type of food. So I worked at that company for about 4 years and then ended up at more of a natural, not necessarily organic, but more of like a natural food company. Creating products, doing nutrition panels for them, kind of regulatory work, stuff like that. While I was there, I was the one that got the non-GMO verified stamp for their product. So I had to submit ingredient info, all that kind of stuff. They got a lot of their products non-GMO verified. Kind of during that time, so I still was definitely on board with organic, thought non-GMO was better. But I kind of started second guessing it while I was in that role, just because the way that you get the non-GMO stamp, I was just kind of realizing like it didn't really necessarily mean that the products were healthier. So I kind of started second guessing it, still didn't really look into the science of it. I mean, I was fortunate enough to have enough money to buy organic food. So I was just like, why not? I think it's healthier. I'll buy organic. So then fast forward to I became a mom about 3.5 years ago. My daughter actually had a stroke in utero. And she was born with, we were in the NICU for a few weeks. I don't know if it kind of, I feel like all this kind of correlated with that, not only because, you know, she needed a lot of medical care. It wasn't that I was ever really like, you know, against medicine or against doctors, but I guess I was fortunate enough to never really like need to rely on doctors or medicine. So, and now I was literally, my daughter wouldn't be here if it weren't for doctors and modern medicine. So I think maybe that kind of got me started on the path of more like evidence-based thinking, I guess is what you could say.
Sure. Yeah.
And then also in conjunction with that, becoming a mom, I just kind of realized how much of the fear-based marketing is targeted towards moms. And even the company I was working at, I mean, I wasn't a mom at the time, but like a lot of the decisions, our target market at that company was moms with young children. And that was one of the drivers for making their products non-GMO or organic. It's a, you know, those are marketing labels targeted towards mostly moms that want to feed their kids the best food that they can. So I think that also kind of played into it. Just, you know, me myself being scared, like, oh, if I don't buy my daughter the organic, you know, pureed vegetables, is that bad? So I think I just started looking into it more and just wondering myself, like, am I really, like, is this really actually healthier for her? Do I need to be buying this? And I guess the more I actually looked into the science of it, I was like, wow, this is actually kind of the opposite of what I had been just thinking, even though I worked in the organic or in the food industry. Like, I was never really taught that being a chemical engineer and never really looked into it. So yeah, the more I looked into it, I was just really surprised that everything I believed really wasn't true.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing all of that, Jen, did you?
Yeah. So tell us then how you said you were, you know, after that time, you spent some time then in the conventional sector. Is that?
Yeah. So the first job I worked at was more the conventional side.
Oh, okay. And
at the time, I just personally thought organic was better. Again, not really ever looking into the science of it or anything. So I had that experience, and then I actually kind of wanted to work at more of a natural company because that's the kind of consumer I was. So I wanted to work at more of a natural and organic company. And then when I did, I kind of realized more how much these labels are just really marketing labels.
So Erin, can you speak to maybe a little bit more, you know, given your experience in both the conventional and the organic sectors,
yep.
You know, what are the main differences between organic and conventionally grown? I know there's a lot of misconceptions in the general population about the difference between these two. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. So the USDA National Organic Program is a set of processing regulations. So when you see a product with the certified organic label on it, it has nothing to do with the safety or the nutrition of the food. Basically, it's a set of processes that farmers, food processors, they have to follow in order to get their products organic certified. So things like certain natural pesticides are approved. Some synthetic pesticides are also approved. But there's also ones that are not approved that are approved for conventional. Any meat that's organic comes from animals that have to eat organic feed. And then there's not any GMOs allowed in organic either. So they're a set of processing regulations. They don't necessarily mean that any of these things don't necessarily make the food any healthier or safer than conventional.
So then because you bring up GMOs and you say, you know, the organic label has nothing necessarily to do with safety or nutrition of the food for a human. Can you speak more to like GMOs and maybe if there are any environmental like benefits of GMOs or any detriments to GMOs, and kind of speak towards people who might you know, feel that that's why they should make that decision to buy from the non-GMO verified labels?
Yeah, so GMO is kind of a term that the way that the non-GMO project uses the term GMO isn't necessarily the way scientists use the term. So GMO, yeah, so GMO, genetically modified, is an umbrella term kind of including all of the ways you can modify genes. So anything from what farmers have been doing thousands of years ago. Again, okay, so I should clarify, this is the scientist's definition, not the non-GMO project. Okay. So genetic modification has been going on for thousands of years. All of our foods today are genetically modified in some fashion due to crossbreeding. And then you have one type of way of genetically modifying that many consumers aren't even aware of. It's called mutagenesis. So radiation and chemicals are used to induce random mutations in crops. That technique has been used since the 1930s. Thousands of crops have been modified that way. They are not considered GMO according to organic or the non-GMO project. So all of those crops can be labeled organic and non-GMO.
And what are some of those crops?
So the one that's, I think, the most known is the grapefruit. I think it's the ruby red grapefruit. So it's a mutagenic crop, and they used it to make the flesh pinker. There were some other traits that they use mutagenesis for.
Maybe
as well.
Slightly sweeter, as yeah. Grapefruits can be a little yeah. bit thinner.
Yeah, perhaps. So many people don't know about that. And yeah, those can be labeled as organic and non-GMO. And both of those are highly random and they're unregulated. Not to say that the food that's created via those methods is not safe. It's very safe. Okay.
Sounds a little scary, you know.
Yeah, it totally. Yeah, it does. But the crops that are, you know, made with those methods are, I mean, they're safe. They've been around for thousands of years. There haven't been any adverse effects from them. So then you get into genetic engineering, which is what the non-GMO project considers GMO. So that's things like transgenesis, where you're actually going in and splicing traits into the gene. So there's only 10 crops that are transgenic crops that are approved in the US right now. So that's one thing a lot of people don't know either, is that it's not like there's a bunch of genetically engineered food in our grocery store. There's only 10 crops that have been modified this way. So that method is highly precise, highly regulated. It takes about 13 years for a genetically engineered crop to be studied and then released into the marketplace after it's been extensively studied. And then you have more recently, I don't know if you've heard of the Arctic apples, that the non-browning apples.
Yes, I was actually just going to bring those up. I have a colleague who has worked with Arctic apples, and she traveled to go and see, you know, the grove and everything like that, or the apple orchard.
Yeah.
And I think it was like 20 years that these apples had been in development before they even
right.
were
yep.
released to the public. So like, you know, that's a pretty significant amount of time.
To study yeah. and make sure safe and yep. all is good.
Yep. And so those were created using a technique called gene editing, where they just go in and they actually delete genes that are already there. So you're not inserting any new genes into it. You're just deleting something that is already there. So that's called gene editing. Right now, I don't think it's very clear whether the non-GMO project is going to allow those to be considered non-GMO or not. It sounds like they won't. It sounds like those will be considered GMOs according to the non-GMO project. So gene editing is very precise as well, just like transgenesis, and it's very highly regulated. Like you said, it takes a really long time for crops modified that way to be released into the marketplace after all of the testing that they go through. So that's, when you kind of understand that, you can see how arbitrary, I guess, you know, the non-GMOs definition of what a GMO is. So they only consider those, the more recent, highly regulated, way more precise techniques as genetically modified. And that's what they consider, you know, their products that have their stamp on them can't be modified in the, in those ways.
And like you said, Erin, there's only 10 crops that are right. in the United States that are currently genetically modified with that. What is
yep.
it?
With transgenic crops. Yep. There's only 10.
And one of those is cotton, if I'm correct, right?
Yep.
So it's not all even food.
It's right. not. Nope. And some of it is only animal feed as well. So it's actually, yeah, there's actually less than even 10 in the grocery store that humans consume.
Wow. So I think, like, if I'm not mistaken, maybe you know for sure, but most of, like, the tofu, for example, that we would eat in the grocery store, buy in the grocery store, mm-hmm. would come from organic soybeans or non-GMO soybeans, whereas soybeans grown for feed, for animal feed, those tend to be more genetically modified unless it's a it's feed for an organic animal that's going to be
correct.
Meat.
Right? Yeah. Okay. Yep. Yep. So yeah, soybeans, corn, obviously, canola, there's some potatoes, the rainbow papaya is one, sugar beet, there's a few others, but those are the biggest ones.
I just saw you posted on Instagram that wheat is not a GMO food.
Yeah, a lot of people assume that wheat, there's GMO wheat, and there's not, so I don't know. I don't know where that comes from, but a lot of people just assume that there is GMO wheat on the market and there's not. What's interesting is they're actually working on a genetically modified wheat to get rid of the gluten allergy. So they're trying to genetically modify wheat so people with celiac can actually consume it, which is really interesting.
That's so interesting and something to be totally celebrated.
Yeah. Right. Oh, definitely. Yeah. Yeah.
Like people with celiac, like my dad, for example, like... Yep. Might be able to have bread
and beer
at some point.
and an Allagash Brewing Company beer.
Yep.
So that kind of is a good segue into, you know, a lot of people, that's all really interesting information. And it's wonderful that there is actually so much time spent on studying these foods before they're released into the market. But I think a lot of people are just fearful of maybe the unknown and the assumption of how scary it sounds to modify something from nature. Can you speak to that at all? Like, are there actually any consequences that we should be concerned of from GMOs or even from pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, you know, anything within that non-GMO and organic world?
Yeah. So as far as the GMOs go, I mean, there's no reason to be more scared of, like I said, these newer genetic engineering techniques than crossbreeding or mutagenesis. I mean, they're just different ways of accomplishing the same end goal. So a lot of consumers are fearful because they don't understand the process, whereas what they look at before releasing something into the marketplace is the end product. We have to understand that the process isn't necessarily what we need to be worried about. It's the end product. So you can create herbicide tolerant crops from crossbreeding or mutagenesis, or you can create them with these newer methods. So it's not that any of them are creating like less safe or more safe foods. They're all creating safe foods. And the ones that are created with these newer methods, they are tested a lot more to make sure that no new allergens are introduced. If it is something that, you know, like the genetically modified corn, they have to make sure that the nutritional profile is the same as the non-GMO. So they have to, there are certain requirements that have to be met before they are released into the marketplace. So by the time that happens, there's nothing unknown that would contribute to something happening with people's health or anything like that. And they've been around for 20 plus years and there's been no cases of any health consequences whatsoever. So there's really no reason why there would even be more of, you know, a fear from these newer techniques versus crossbreeding, which, like I said, has been around for thousands of years. It's just a different way of getting to the same end product. But the product is what has to be assessed for safety and nutrition and not the process.
Right. Wow. That's really interesting. And that's information that, you know, is so hard pressed to really find or at least understand to like the, you know,
right.
regular everyday people, especially us moms who have been targeted left and right about, you know, non-GMO foods. And even so, like kind of going back to the wheat thing, you know, we kind of understand these things through how we buy them at the grocery store. So the marketing labels, you know, so if it says non-GMO, I'm going to assume that means that there's GMO, another version of the food with the GMO.
Exactly. You know? That's a huge thing too. And so that's one reason, you know, why it is definitely, it's definitely used for marketing purposes and not to show that something is healthier. So, I mean, you can even find bottled water with the non-GMO label on it. So, I mean, it's things like that. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, a lot of people see a non-GMO label on orange juice and they assume the one sitting next to it without the non-GMO label must be GMO. And if this one's labeled non-GMO, well, GMOs must be bad. You know what I mean? So it's that kind of thinking that it makes sense that you would think that way, but that's just not how it is. Just because there's a label out there that's non-GMO, that doesn't mean that GMOs are bad for you.
Mm. Wow. Thank you so much. That's so clarifying because it's confusing, especially with just the world of navigating what's healthiest and what's best and trying to pursue what we think is right for our families and making the decisions for our families.
Right. And of course, parents want to, you know, provide the best that they can for their children, for mm-hmm. their, you know, for themselves too.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate that I think food companies would take advantage, I guess, of that lack of understanding or fear or.
Yeah. Right. Like organic and non-GMO are definitely fear-based marketing labels. So like I said, if something with non-GMO, people are scared, like, why would this say non-GMO if GMOs are safe? It must not be safe. But that's just not true. Also, organic has done a great job at making people think that it's pesticide-free, which is not true at all. Organic, like I said earlier, organic can use pesticides. Just because they use natural pesticides doesn't mean that they're better than synthetic. A lot of the natural pesticides are even more toxic and worse for the environment. So
really?
Yeah. So that's one thing too. I mean, you say the word natural, people think it's better, but that's not true at all. Saying something's natural, you can't infer any safety information from just saying something's natural versus synthetic.
Botulism's natural, right?
Exactly. I mean, yeah. there's thousands of chemicals that are natural that will kill you. So it's to say like, oh, well, it's better because they use natural pesticides. That's not true either, because what happens is they're actually not allowed to use a lot of the synthetic pesticides that have been made to be less toxic and safer for the environment, and they're not allowed to use those. So in a lot of instances, they're using a natural pesticide that doesn't work as well. So they're spraying more on the crop and it's more toxic. So it actually is counterintuitive to what you would think.
Wow. So you could actually be doing maybe even more harm by buying a certain organic food if that's...
Well, so the thing, so we can get into pesticide residues too. So there is no risk as far as to our health with pesticide residues. So even by saying, oh, they might use more toxic pesticide, I mean, a lot of that has to do with the farmers applying it. And all of the pesticide residues that we consume on our products are at very low levels. So even on organic or conventional, there's no reason to worry about the almost undetectable levels of pesticide residues.
Erin, have you heard of the website safefruitsandveggies.com?
I'm not sure.
That's one that I heard about at a conference probably about a year ago. And I forget what the organization that kind of licensed the website, but it's basically a website where people can go and they can calculate the number of servings of certain fruits and vegetables, organic and conventional. And so you go to the website and you say, you know, I'm a female, and you pick a food.
Oh,
and
yeah, I actually did post that. Yeah. Yep. During all the, whenever they released the Dirty Dozen list, I posted that for people to look at. Yeah.
So you go there and you choose the fruit or vegetable, and it will tell you how many servings you can have. If that food had the highest recorded rate of pesticide residues, you could consume this many servings without even getting close to like a toxic level.
Yeah. So the way that the pesticide, so those are also regulated. I mean, farmers aren't just spraying pesticides on, and you know, it's not like nobody's checking to see how much is on there. So that's regulated as well. The USDA has a pesticide detection program where they take produce and they test what the levels are on both organic and conventional, what the levels of pesticides are to make sure they're within the EPA limit. And how the EPA sets their limits is based on a bunch of toxicological data. So they set their limits very, very conservatively. And the pesticide residues are typically hundreds to thousands times below the EPA's conservative limit. So a lot of the fears, obviously, you've heard around glyphosate and glyphosate residues. And a lot of that fear mongering comes from the organic side, of course, because it's not an organic approved pesticide. So, you know, they're trying to create fear around it so people will buy organic.
To clarify, glyphosate is the Roundup chemical.
Yeah, that's
right?
The active ingredient in Roundup. Yeah. Yep. So that's a pesticide used in conventional. It's not allowed in organic. However, I mean, organic uses pesticides that are much more toxic than that as well. So, you know, the fear that's been created around glyphosate, and then, you know, the EWG, they do a lot of the testing. You heard about glyphosate in your breakfast cereal and in Cheerios, right? And all that kind of stuff. But yet,
and lawsuits about it.
Yeah, but they never test for organic pesticides, and they don't even mention the fact that organic uses pesticides. So
really, yeah,
you can see kind of how biased, you know, the organizations like the EWG are. They're specifically only testing for conventional pesticides. So obviously conventional foods are going to have the pesticides and organic foods aren't. If you were testing for organic, it would be the opposite. But either way, the pesticide residues are not an issue at all. Our food is very safe.
So we don't have to worry then, you're saying, about like, I know that the idea of like toxic load. So, you know, you might eat something that is conventional and be okay today, but if you spend a whole lifetime eating it, you know, there's a fear that the toxic load adds up and makes the difference.
So the EPA's limits are all the toxicological data, and their limits are set on the chronic toxicity of all these chemicals. So chronic toxicity takes into account whether it accumulates in the body, how fast our body gets rid of it. So that is all in their data and what they use to create those pesticide tolerance levels, which the USDA tests to make sure they're all under those levels. But when you, the actual amount of pesticide residue that we're consuming is so incredibly small. I mean, I think people have this, you know, vision that it's just like coated in pesticides and like we're, you know, overloading our bodies. And it's just, it's these are parts per million or parts per billion. These are tiny, tiny, tiny levels. Not to mention the fact that plants themselves produce their own natural pesticides. That's their defense mechanism. So we actually consume 99.99% of the pesticides we consume are the pesticides produced by the plants themselves. So to be scared about this 0.01% that's coming from farmers spraying it on the foods just doesn't really make sense. And it comes back to that whole natural thing. It's like, well, the plants are, you know, creating these pesticides naturally, so why would we be scared of that? But those chemicals can be just as toxic as the ones that they're spraying on it. So it doesn't make sense to be unnecessarily scared of this small amount of pesticides that's being sprayed onto the produce.
Or spend all of our grocery budget on just a few
right.
organic items.
Yeah.
What I've done in the past, I'm so guilty of that.
Yeah, so that's one thing too with the Dirty Dozen list. So the EWG, like I said, not only, so they take the USDA's data, and what they do is all they take into account is how many pesticides each thing has on it. So let's say they detect 7 different pesticides on strawberries and they only detect 5 on apples. Like, strawberries is going to be at the top of their list. They're not even taking into account what chemical it is, how much is on there. So it's completely not helpful at all. And all they're trying to do is to drive people to buy more organic foods based on fear, which is there shouldn't be any fear around any food, conventional or organic.
Amen to that.
Yes, that we do not like food fear here.
And just to back up just for a second, so you mentioned the EWG a couple times, so I'm not sure if we spelled that out. So the EWG is the Environmental Working Group, and they are the ones that release, what is it, the yearly Dirty Dozen and Clean 15 list. So,
yep.
Yeah. So that's knowing that they don't really really delve into the information any further than just like this one has 7 and this
exactly.
one has 5.
Yep. Yeah. Also, the USDA tests the organic produce as well, and they don't mention that at all. They don't mention anything about organic having any pesticide residues whatsoever. So it's very, very biased.
So then is there any reason at all to buy organic foods? Like, is it better for the environment, or, you know, is there any benefit to the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15 and following these rules?
So I definitely would say there's no benefit to the Dirty Dozen, Clean 15. If anything, it's causing people to consume less produce because they are scared, so they'll buy organic, and organic is more expensive, so they might not buy as much. Or I've heard a lot of people too, they'll go to the store and something isn't available in organic, and they just, you know, they'll go to buy some strawberries and they're scared about buying conventional, so they just won't buy any at all. So it's actually doing a lot more harm than good, because it's making people not eat healthy fruits and vegetables. So I definitely think it's not beneficial at all, and it's actually doing more harm.
Wow. Well, one thing I've heard a lot over the course of my work is people stating the difference between taste, and that one always really interests me. You know, people that say organic foods taste better and they look better, and it sounds to me like, based on our conversation today, that's just really the farm or the, maybe, you know, where it's grown or the seasonality, and not so much whether it's organic or not. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's hard to turn off our internal bias as well. I mean, if we have it in our heads that organic is better, and we eat something organic and we're just like, oh, that tastes so much better, it's organic. So it's hard to say a lot of times, like, does it really taste better, or is it, or are you just biased? And also, yeah, it has to do with the farming practices. I mean, I grow tomatoes out in my little garden. I think they definitely taste better than the ones that I buy at the store. And this isn't to say, you know, like, if you think something that you buy at the store that is organic tastes better than the conventional, go ahead and buy it. Any way that you can eat more fruits and vegetables, do that. So, you know, it's not to say like, oh, don't buy organic. It's just to let people know that organic isn't any healthier or safer. If you think that a certain thing at the store organic tastes better, I mean, by all means, go ahead and buy it. It doesn't necessarily taste better either. There's no really way of really proving that. But yeah, I mean, even within organic farming and conventional farming, you know, each farm has different farming practices. So it will taste different farm to farm as well.
Yeah. Wow. That's a great answer. And I love that, how inclusive you are to say, like, no, the idea is we want to enjoy our food and we want to make sure we're eating plenty of produce, and however that makes sense for your family, do it. And I think now for a lot of our listeners, it's going to be really eye-opening to hear that organic might actually be doing more harm than good. And, you know, for me, hearing that and understanding that definitely makes a huge difference, because it relieves some of that pressure to always be buying. Because, you know, at the end of the day, if it's not necessarily healthier for me, you know, maybe it's healthier for somebody or the environment or something. So I want to support that. But it kind of sounds like from our conversation today that that's not even.
Yeah. And actually, organic actually isn't better for the environment either. Because that was one thing too, when I used to buy it, I was like, I was kind of on the fence of whether it was actually healthier. But I always, my thing was always like, well, I want to support what's better for the environment. And I always believed that organic was better. But it actually isn't better for the environment. The biggest reason why organic isn't better for the environment is because organic farmers grow a lot less food on a lot more land. So obviously, the more you can grow on the less land is going to be the most environmentally friendly. GMOs allow for farmers to grow more crops using less land. So that's one huge reason why conventional actually is better for the environment than organic. Also, insect-resistant GMO crops lead to less insecticide use. So over the last 20 years, GMOs have reduced pesticide applications by 8.1%, and then they also increase crop yields. So the notion that organic is better for the environment just isn't supported by the science either, and that was one thing that was my reasoning for always buying organic, and that just isn't true either.
Yeah, I mean, I think hopefully you can't pick up on my bias too much, but, you know, like we were saying before, like in my work as a dietitian, I've seen exactly what you've been saying, you know, play out where people are avoiding fruits and vegetables because they either can't afford organic, or it's not in season, or it's not available. Mm-hmm. And it really kind of creates this like inequality. Mm-hmm. And even if conventional and organic produce, I think, were like neutral, if they were kind of like a neutral or equivalent, you know, effect on the environment, I think what kind of sticks in my mind is that the organic sector has gone so hard into making us fear the other side, which I don't know, that just kind of makes me a bit angry. And and you know, even me kind of knowing what I know as a dietitian, you know, I've done some of my own work and own reading into an education around organic versus conventional, and I kind of probably align very well with what you're speaking to, Erin. Mm-hmm. I still find myself like doubting myself every once in a while, you know, like even knowing what I know, I'm just like, well, no, I probably should weigh organic just in case, because like I feel like
it's like moral. There's a moral.
I know. It's crazy. Yeah. I have the same thought sometimes, and I'm like, why am I still thinking this? Yeah, it almost becomes part of your belief system. Like, oh, if I can afford this, you know, I need to do what's best. And it's, even when you know that's not what the truth is, it's really hard to let that go.
Yeah, the power of the, you know, this the culture and the culture has
definitely
like overwhelmed us.
Yeah.
And like, going back to just like from a parental perspective, we always want what is best for our families, and these companies and the marketing tactics and strategies and campaigns do a really good job at making us feel like, well, you should be doing this and you could be doing better.
Yeah, they're definitely taking advantage of that for sure. And everyone says, you know, big egg and big food to kind of talk about the conventional side. And it's almost like they think organic doesn't do the same thing, but they definitely do. And they actually, you know, you don't ever hear conventional creating fear against organic. So, I mean, the organic side is really the only one trying to create fear against conventional so that you'll buy organic, because otherwise, why would you pay more for something that isn't any better for you? I mean, they have to create a market, and that's how they're doing that, is to create fear.
Wow. So this might be a huge stretch, but I'm just going to say it. Do you think that the Environmental Working Group, the EWG, is the organic equivalent of what we're made to believe it's Monsanto.
Monsanto is different since they, you know, create products. Whereas
people who are fear big ag. Yeah. And like
Monsanto's the devil.
Monsanto the devil.
EWG is going to save us.
And tell us all the information.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. And they don't realize that the EWG is funded by a lot of different organic companies. So obviously they're biased. We can't just take their data and just, you know, it's biased for sure. So, and Monsanto does get demonized a lot because everyone equates GMOs and Roundup to Monsanto. But in reality, there's so many different seed companies that sell GMOs, and now there's a lot of different companies that sell glyphosate. So to just say that they're in control of all of this isn't true either.
And now we know as an audience, you know, that from what you've shared with us today, that there's nothing to fear.
Right. No. And one of the things that a lot of people, you know, you hear all the myths about Monsanto and that, oh, they patent their seeds, which is true, but organic seeds are patented too. Hybrid seeds are patented. So a lot of the fear mongering that goes into things like that is happening on the organic side as well. It's just nobody talks about it. So these things just really aren't true. And there's just a lot of myths going around.
Yeah, I think that's what's like really hard to wrap. You know, coming into this interview, I already was a skeptic of the organic world, but I wasn't always that way. You know, I was fully immersed in that. I come from a background of naturopathic medicine and being in an integrative health center and just kind of holistic health, and how like that group think that exists in that world is like, that natural is best because it comes from the earth, and that is what is going to be the healthiest for us, because that makes sense. That's really easy to like understand.
Yeah. And our intuitive toxicology is typically very flawed in that way, where we tend to underestimate natural risk and we overestimate man-made risk. So that's a great example of that, is just thinking everything natural is harmless when we know that's not true at all. There's a lot of natural chemicals that are very toxic.
And it kind of reminds me of how like children's like experience neophobia, which is kind of around food, which is just like the automatic disposition to fear new foods.
Yeah.
And to fear the introduction of new foods for just out of like self-preservation, you know, safety mechanisms. And that kind of reminds me of what we're talking about today, in that like, we might be just naturally predisposed to fear the changes and GMOs. Yeah. and these sprays and everything, because it seems scary and it seems unnatural, and we might think the earth is already ready to do its thing, and so why mess with that?
Right.
You know, that's
yeah.
what I've heard.
Yeah, and I hear that a lot, and it's like farming in and of itself is not natural. I mean, these foods are not just growing out in the wild. I mean, none of this stuff that we're doing with food is natural. So to say that organic is natural and conventional isn't, I mean, as far as growing crops the way that we do, I mean, they're not just growing out in the wild, and all of the crossbreeding that we've done to make things edible that the way that they are today, none of those things are natural. So
like they didn't just happen
exactly
like by accident.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the modern day banana, if you look at a picture of one thousands of years ago, it had tons of seeds and wasn't even edible. So I mean, these things have been crossbred over time. So even the things that in the grocery store are labeled as natural and organic and non-GMO, I mean, if you really get into it, they're not really natural. I mean, we've been selectively breeding these things for thousands of years.
So I have a question then for you, because we talked quickly about glyphosate, and I've seen that there are a lot of lawsuits around it and like potential like links to cancer.
Yep.
Can you talk about that at all? And what,
yeah,
you know,
so,
if people are hearing this information but have heard that too, that's kind of confusing.
Yeah, it is confusing. And so the thing with glyphosate, it's one of the most tested chemicals in history. There have been hundreds of tests done on it. not one has shown an increased risk of cancer. So the largest test was with 55,000 people that are exposed to glyphosate at very high levels. They were followed for decades. They found no increased risk of cancer. So all of these lawsuits that are happening now, basically, I mean, all they're doing is they're convincing a jury that this, you know, everyone's heard of glyphosate now, that this scary sounding chemical is causing people's cancer. I mean, you have to remember juries don't determine scientific facts. So to use that in place of scientific evidence, you can't do that. I mean, the scientific evidence doesn't show an increased risk of cancer. Yes, people are winning lawsuits against it, but juries don't determine the scientific facts.
Mm-hmm. So what you're kind of saying is basically like the bias that we all experience because of this heavy marketing, you know, ploy, I guess I will call it, is the human bias that the juries are experiencing. And so that's why
these things are passing. Yeah, I mean, they're being convinced that a person sitting in front of them with cancer, you know, is being caused by this chemical. These people aren't scientists. I mean, it's not too hard to see how a bunch of people can be convinced that this person sitting in front of them that has used this chemical their whole life, you know, has caused their cancer. So yes, people are winning, but the science doesn't support that it has an increased risk of cancer.
Mm-hmm. I remember this makes me think of a quote that I heard, that it is easier to trick people than to convince people they have been tricked.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one. Yeah.
And I think I actually heard that quote. Have you seen the documentary Food Evolution, Erin?
Yes. Yep.
What did you think of the documentary?
I thought it was great. Yeah.
I actually hosted a screening for that documentary like a year and a half ago or so for one of my dietetics organization. Just because I thought it was like a very well put together documentary. And I will say that, like, you know, at one point I thought that Food Inc. was like the best documentary ever.
Right. Yeah. Me too.
And so, like, I mean, documentaries all have like a very impassioned, you know, bias that they're going in with, I think, in general, like they're mm-hmm. always trying to prove a point. I mean, right. Any piece of, you know, editorial type stuff.
Right. Take with a grain of salt.
Right. We'll have a point to drive home. But yeah, I thought it was a really well-made documentary. We'll definitely link it in the show notes if you're interested in taking another look.
For the audience.
Yeah, definitely.
And we actually got to Skype in with the director of the, like, he was from LA and we were just like in our, you know, movie seats at like Southern Maine Community College in Maine and talked to the director. And it was a good experience.
Oh my gosh. I'll have to watch it. I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. I mean, and that one is definitely based on science too. I mean, that's the difference between that one and Food Inc. Food Inc. definitely wasn't based on science. So.
So that leaves me to because I want to be respectful of your time because we're getting close to an hour here, but so the three of us, I guess I could safely say we are reformed. We have we've seen the light and we now understand that it's more important to follow the science here, and now with this information we can make better choices and
not based out of fear,
but based on what works for our families, what looks good in the grocery store, what our budgets can afford. And that gives us some freedom. But for our audience who's just maybe learning this and just starting to come to terms with the information that we've shared today, could you share where can parents or just people find reliable information about like food safety or where can people go and turn to for information when they inevitably get inundated with false marketing claims again?
Yeah, so there's some good resources, obviously my Facebook page or my Instagram page, but other than that, so there's Sci Moms. They're also on Facebook. They have a really good website with really good science-based information. Biology Fortified is another one. A lot of plant geneticists, scientists write for them. There's some really good articles on there. The Genetic Literacy Project, specifically for GMO information, they're a great resource. The other thing too, I follow a lot of farmers on Facebook just because, I mean, a lot of us don't really know any farmers and we have a lot of misconceptions about farming. I hear people say a lot of things about farming and it's like, you know, you should really talk to a farmer because that's not actually what's happening.
Yes.
So
there aren't many of them and we need them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Farm Babe is a great one. The Farmer's Daughter. And then another one is TDF Honest Farming. He's really great. He shares videos all the time on his dairy farm. And then Ag Daily is a good one too. I actually write articles for them. Just more agricultural based articles. A lot of people are so far removed from farming. I mean, I know I didn't grow up on a farm. I don't really know any farmers either. So we have a lot of preconceived things we hear on documentaries like Food Inc. and they're just not true. So I think it's important to talk to real farmers.
Yeah. And kind of like what we were saying earlier, you know, you kind of gather your information based on what you're seeing, and what we're seeing is the information, you know, that is being heavily marketed.
Yep.
And
yeah,
that isn't right. necessarily what science is telling
right.
us. And so it's hard to know. And it's important to have the proper resources to gather this
exactly.
information.
Yeah.
What a fun outing for a family if you have access to go to a farm and talk to a farmer and learn about food and like have them answer your questions or concerns. Like I'm pretty sure, you know, a lot of farmers, I mean, I've probably met like a handful of farmers, but I think they're pretty well equipped. Like they know their business inside and out. They know their animals or their practices inside and out. So I'm pretty sure from my experience, they can answer any question that you might have about, you know, pesticides or, you know, any of our safety, any of those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So yeah, do an outing, take your family to a farm.
Yeah. How fun. And yeah, that's, so I guess on that note, Erin, what is one thing you wish you could tell every single family or person to help them find a little bit of food freedom?
Yeah. So I think the biggest thing is just not to be afraid of our food. We have the safest food supply in history right now. So safe. In fact, I think people are looking at things that are very low risk and kind of blowing it up just because our food is so safe. There really isn't anything to be afraid of. So all these risks that we're seeing are really, really, really not risks at all. So I think the biggest thing is to just not be afraid of your food, especially produce. I mean, it's going to be worse for your health. Like I said before, if you're buying less produce because you're afraid of the pesticide residues versus not being afraid and eating as much produce as you can. So I think that's the biggest thing is just not to be afraid of your food.
What a great sentiment to end this conversation on. Thank you so much for your time. I think it's funny that when we first started the podcast, we were like, yeah, we'll keep the episodes to 30 minutes.
Yeah.
So, and we're running into like 54 minutes.
And I could keep talking, you know, I could keep going, but this has been amazing, Erin. We are going to link all of your social media handles and where people can find you in our show notes. And we just, from the bottom of our hearts, thank you for coming on and helping clarify exactly what's going on out there.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, have a good one. You've been listening to the Food Confidence Podcast. I'm Jennifer Bravo.
And I'm Andrea Paul.
If you have any questions about the things you heard in today's episode or have topics you'd like us to discuss in the future, send us an email at foodconfidencepod@gmail.com or follow us and message us on Instagram at foodconfidencepod.